Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning. We are here today on our first case, 2019-896, the City of Cincinnati versus the Fourth National Realty Company, LLC. Sitting in place of Justice Fisher this morning is Judge Robin Piper from the 12th District. And in place of Justice DeWine, we have Judge William Klatt from the 10th District. Welcome, judges.
Good morning. Thank you.
For the appellant, we have Mr. Manning.
Yes, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
Thank you. Chief Justice, may it please the court, good morning. I'm Mark Manning on behalf of Appellant City of Cincinnati. I would like to request 3 minutes for rebuttal. The First District erred when it held that service on the Attorney General pursuant to Revised Code 272112 did not have to be completed at the inception of the case. In reaching its decision, the First District ignored the text as well as the purpose of the statute and this court's precedents in Chico versus Stockmeyer. When a party fails to serve the Attorney General at the inception of the case, it deprives the Attorney General of having a meaningful opportunity to participate or be heard, and is inherently prejudicial to the Attorney General as well as the parties. For those reasons, this court should reverse the First District Court of Appeals and hold that service on the Attorney General pursuant to Revised Code 272112 must occur at the inception of the case. In 1933, the General Assembly passed the statute that would later be recodified as Revised Code 272112 as part of the Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act. And in 2000, this court in Chico versus Stockmeyer had the opportunity to interpret that statute and specifically what was required in terms of the timing as well as the service on the Attorney General. And this court held in Chico that it was necessary to for there to be jurisdiction for the Attorney General to be served consistent with Civil Rule 4.1 and for that service to occur at the inception of the case. And to reach that conclusion.
You keep saying the inception of the case, but you would agree that it's also when the constitutional issue is first raised, correct?
Correct. The language inception of the case is the language that this court used in Chico and subsequently in the Mayer versus Bristow decision as well. And I believe it first arose in the Citizens for Fair Representation versus Taft, where the issue of service on the Attorney General came up in that case as well. But the language that is used or the purpose is to assure that the Attorney General is notified at the earliest opportunity in the case, and so that the Attorney General has a fair opportunity to participate and make a determination.
But Counselor, the Attorney General did have an opportunity to participate and decided not to in this case, right? So where's the harm?
So correct, the Attorney General did have the opportunity, but this court was clear that in Chico it wasn't enough to have an opportunity, that it had to be a meaningful opportunity to participate in the case.
But shouldn't it be the Attorney General that asserts the lack of a meaningful opportunity?
Well, no, Your Honor, because this court has been clear going back to the 1970s that the requirement of service on the Attorney General is a jurisdictional requirement, and that serving the Attorney General and giving the Attorney General that opportunity to be heard is necessary to establish the court's jurisdiction, which means that it can be raised by any party at any time, including the court sua sponte.
Counsel, when did the issue or the need for the Attorney General's notice come about?
When was it first raised, Your Honor?
What was the trigger that would have included the Attorney General?
The counterclaim, which was filed by Fourth National in this case, I believe it was early on in the case in 2015. This case progressed for 2.5 years before the Attorney General was actually served. But the late service on the Attorney General does have an impact both on the parties as well as the Attorney General. The first issue, as I was alluding to with Justice Stewart, was that there's a jurisdictional problem that's created when the Attorney General is not served at the inception of the case. This court has been clear since the 1970s that it's a fundamental requirement in a declaratory judgment action to serve the Attorney General, and that in the absence of serving the Attorney General, there's no jurisdiction to act, which means
what's your precedent for using the word jurisdiction? I mean, clearly the Attorney General, even if he had been served from the outset, as you said, could have at that time decided it's not necessary for the Attorney General to be a part of this. And so that to me suggests that it's not jurisdictional. We might want to talk about prejudice, but what's your precedent for using jurisdiction?
So this court in Molloy versus Westlake in 1977 said that it's a jurisdictional requirement and has held to that requirement through a number of decisions since that decision in Molloy, both in Chico as well as I think subsequent to that in the Mayer versus Bristow case as well. So there's a series of precedents by this court that recognize that it's a jurisdictional requirement to serve the Attorney General.
So what do you really win if this court was to decide that it is jurisdictional? It would just go back to, and we reversed, wouldn't it just go back to that first counterclaim that was filed? And then wouldn't the path be exactly the same as what occurred?
No, Your Honor. Well, this case has progressed for 2.5 years. And so over the course of those 2.5 years, the various aspects of the case has been litigated. And various aspects of the case have been decided, including the trial court actually issued a substantive decision early on in the case about the city, about the declaratory judgment claim, the counterclaim, finding that the city's ordinance was in fact constitutional under the Central Hudson test. But the various other claims that have been asserted both by the city and Fourth National have been resolved. And so the only claim that remains, I believe, at this point is the declaratory judgment claim, which Fourth National, according to the decision by the First District, can pursue an as-applied challenge to the ordinance with respect to a sign that they wish to erect on their property. And so if the city were to win here, and that the court would decide that the failure to serve the Attorney General at the inception did deprive the Attorney General of having a meaningful opportunity to participate or be heard, then the case would effectively be over, although I do think Fourth National would potentially be able to refile based upon the claims that it has remaining at this point. But it would dispose of the case. Unless this court would agree with the First District, then of course the case would be remanded at that point for further litigation on that declaratory judgment claim. But this case in many ways is an excellent illustration of the prejudicial impact that can occur both on the Attorney General as well as cities or other jurisdictions that are defending cases similar. And as I indicated,
Counsel, was there prejudice here? I mean, the Attorney General obviously has the option to opt out. Is that correct? So they are dispensable for the case.
Correct. Your Honor, the First District concluded that there was no prejudice, but there was frankly nothing in the record or with regard to the arguments of the parties about whether or not the Attorney General or the parties were prejudiced by accepting service late. And so the Attorney General, the only communication that's in the record is the letter which was sent by the Attorney General to the parties that was filed.
Whose burden is it to show prejudice here?
Well, Your Honor, since it's a jurisdictional requirement, it's on the party asserting that there is jurisdiction to establish that there is jurisdiction. So in this case, it would be Fourth National. And there's nothing within the communication from the Attorney General which indicates whether or not there was any prejudice. And in fact, there was a statement in its notice to the court which stated that that no assumptions should be drawn regarding its declining to participate beyond the fact it was declining to participate. Despite that fact, the First District concluded that there was no prejudice.
Well, counsel, wouldn't that statement go to both a statement as to the merits of the case as well as any prejudice?
No, Your Honor, because the representation made or the comment made by the Attorney General was that they were declining to participate in the merits of the case and that the parties should not, or the court should not, draw any inferences from that beyond the fact that they were declining to participate. So that would include whether or not they were prejudiced. And if you look at the procedural posture with which they were notified, I think that illustrates very effectively the prejudice, because in this case, the Attorney General was notified almost 900 days into the litigation, where there were cross motions for summary judgment, which were filed and then decided by the trial court, where the trial court rendered a substantive decision finding the city's ordinance to be constitutional that was then
appealed. What was the city's response when the Attorney General declined to participate?
I'm not sure if I understand your question, Your Honor. Are you asking if the city...
When was your jurisdictional challenge filed?
The city raised the jurisdictional issue prior to service occurring on the Attorney General. So the issue was raised during the city's second motion for summary judgment, which was about two and a half years into the litigation. At that point, Fourth National attempted to serve the Attorney General a couple of weeks, I believe, after the issue was raised. And the Attorney General, while it was served a few days before the city's motion for summary judgment was ripe, the parties didn't know when the motion became ripe, whether or not the Attorney General would choose to participate or be heard in the case. But by the time that the Attorney General did, in fact, indicate that he was declining to participate or be heard in this case, the case had proceeded so far along that the city's motion for summary judgment was ripe. Both parties had filed their pretrial statements, and they were just a few weeks away from trial. And so the Attorney General was put into the position of having to decide whether or not to intervene in an action that had been pending for 2.5 years, where a summary judgment motion was days away from being ripe for a decision, and the Attorney General would have to insert itself into that and or have to be prepared to go to trial in a few weeks. And that would be prejudicial.
Well, let's take it away from this case. I mean, in this case, the Attorney General said, we're not going to participate. So let's take it into a hypothetical situation where maybe there was this long period of time, maybe there would be some perceived prejudice. Couldn't a trial court fix that? You know, I mean, you could fix it in a number of ways. You could grant a continuance. You could order sanctions against the party that failed to notify the Attorney General in a timely way. Why couldn't you fix whatever prejudice you might be thinking of?
Well, that would certainly fix the prejudice for the Attorney General, but it would still impose a prejudice on the party that's defending the action to have to relitigate aspects of the case for which there is no jurisdiction. So in this case,
couldn't the court address that as well? Couldn't that, and that's where the sanction might come in, to say, now you're going to have to, you know, you failed to give a timely notice to the Attorney General, you're going to have to pay fees.
I suppose that could occur, but ultimately the purpose of this, I see my time is expiring, if I could complete my answer for you, Justice French,
please.
Is that the purpose is to put the Attorney General on the same footing as the parties in the case. And if the
why is that the purpose? Isn't the purpose to give the opportunity for the Attorney General on behalf of the state of Ohio to defend? That's the purpose, is to defend the constitutionality of a state statute. So
I would
go ahead.
No, I would certainly agree with you, Your Honor, that is the purpose. But as this court was clear in Chica, that includes that there be a meaningful opportunity to be heard. And this court has consistently held through its precedents that notifying the Attorney General at the summary judgment phase is simply too late for that meaningful opportunity to occur.
Counsel, why did the city wait to summary judgment stage to raise this jurisdictional challenge and not raise it in the answer, the counterclaim?
Your Honor, it wasn't recognized by the city until that late date, but I would submit that it is the party who is responsible for establishing jurisdiction to complete the service. And so it's not the city's responsibility to raise the issue as much as it is Fourth National's to ensure that there is jurisdiction for the court to render a decision on its claim.
Well, wouldn't a ruling in your favor encourage gamesmanship if you know about this defense and the other side doesn't, and you just wait, like you said, it happened 900 days or so into the litigation, and then springing it on them that they missed this notification requirement?
I think the opportunity for gamesmanship exists if parties don't have to establish jurisdiction early on, and if the Attorney General doesn't get notified or the issue doesn't get raised, there's the possibility that decisions are made that the Attorney General just sits with until potentially years after judgment. And then the issue is raised and says, well, there's never any jurisdiction for that case because the attorney general was never notified. And so the possibility exists for gamesmanship in that respect as well.
Counsel, you're presuming prejudice without evidence, correct?
Correct. There is nothing from the attorney general which indicates that they were prejudiced in this case.
And the city is not saying, gee, you know, we can't do this without the attorney general at our side.
Well, without representing the state, from the city's perspective, many of the claims that are raised in this case do have an impact on the state. So I think the state would have has an interest in participating in this case.
Well, sure, but that's up to the attorney general. I'm saying the city was not left without resources or a path here because the attorney general decided not to join.
That's correct. We're just forced to relitigate an aspect of the case which was already decided.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Holzapfel? You'll have to turn your mic on, sir.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. Eric Holzapfel for the appellee. 272112A sets forth three objective requirements. One, that we serve the Attorney General a copy of the complaint. Two, that we do it pursuant to 4.1 of the civil rules. And three, that the Attorney General shall be heard. We did all that. All of that happened. We met all three requirements. There's no dispute about that. And the First District Court of Appeals agreed and said that we met the requirements of the statute. I think it's well settled that when a statute is clear, and I believe this statute is clear,
Does the statute address the timing of that notice, that service?
The statute does not address timing notice.
It's unclear as to the timing, correct?
Well, I'm not sure it's a clarity question or an omission by the legislature, Your Honor. They had two chances.
How do you deal with CITCO that interprets the statute and says that it shall be at the commencement of when the constitutional issue is arrived? In other words, subject matter jurisdiction is a creature of statute. And then Ohio Supreme Court has interpreted that statute on two occasions and indicated that because the wording in the statute is mandatory, that it is related to jurisdiction. So how do you deal with those two Supreme Court cases?
Well, let's look at CITCO first. The holding in CITCO does not reference when the holding the timing. If you look at the holding, it says that we hold that a party who is challenging the constitutionality of a statute must assert the claim in the complaint. We did. And he must serve the pleading upon the Attorney General in accordance with Rule 4.1.
It goes on to say, or at the beginning of the action or the initial pleading stage in which the constitutional challenge is raised.
Well, here, I don't see that in the holding, Your Honor. I'm looking at the CITCO case, and I'm reading from the CITCO case, and I'm reading what the court said was their holding. There's no question that the court talked about raising it at the inception of the case. I don't know that that adds a lot of clarity. I'm not sure when the inception of a case is. I don't know that that adds anything to the statute.
A case occur when it's filed?
A case does occur when it's filed. And you'll notice that the dissent, and there were three judges that dissented in CITCO, Douglas Pfeiffer and Cook, raised the point that the statute not only refers to the action, but it talks about the word proceeding. If you look at the statute itself, it says that the Attorney General shall be served with a copy of the complaint in the action or proceeding and shall be heard. So a proceeding, according to three judges in the Supreme Court, a proceeding is broader than the term action. And in fact, a motion for summary judgment is a proceeding according to those justices.
And they only needed one more to make that a holding, but they didn't have it. That's a dissent.
They didn't. And I think that they pointed up the fact that we should give effect to all words in a statute. And proceeding is one of the words that the legislature picked. And so if that is correct, this was raised in a motion for summary judgment proceeding. That's when the first was raised. It was not raised at the inception of the case, could have been raised by a 12B1 motion, was not. I don't know if there's gamesmanship involved in this or not. I'm not saying one way or the other, but this case had gone, was decided by summary judgment, went to the Court of Appeals, reversed, back to the trial court, another summary judgment motion was filed, and 2.5 years after the filing of the counterclaim, the city suddenly decides that there's a jurisdictional element to this. And they raised it, and we responded to it, and the Attorney General was heard. The Attorney General responded and said,
That brings me to another question. If subject matter jurisdiction is a creature of statute, and if two previous Supreme Court cases, and I noticed that you didn't address Malloy versus Westlake, which clearly says it's jurisdictional because of the mandatory language in the statute, can prejudice ever, is prejudice something that can confer, take away, or grant jurisdiction? Either you have subject matter jurisdiction or you don't. Isn't that the case?
Yeah, Your Honor, I'm not arguing prejudice. I don't think anybody was prejudiced here. The city wasn't prejudiced. They offered nothing to show that. The Attorney General wasn't prejudiced. Frankly, I think it's up to the Attorney General by this statute. And this, perhaps nobody in these rooms would have written this statute this way. But the legislature did, and they passed on it twice. And they had an opportunity to say in this statute, you've got to serve the Attorney General at a specific time. For example,
when they amended the statute, they added the word complaint, didn't they? Doesn't that indicate that they wanted it to be at the inception?
Not necessarily, because it says serve a copy of the complaint in the action or proceeding. There's two different words there, and I think you have to give effect to both of them under statutory, well-settled principles of statutory construction. And a motion for summary judgment is a proceeding, and it was raised, and the Attorney General was heard, and I think that's all the statute requires. When we start trying to add words to the statute, I think you create maybe more problems than you solve. And in fact, I'm not sure you add clarity. The Supreme Court has mentioned in Chico, inception. By the way, the Malloy case is distinguishable because the Attorney General was never served.
The counterclaim was made, and even after that, it was some time before the Attorney General was notified, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Were you the attorney at the time?
I have been the attorney from day one.
Okay. Is there a reason you didn't serve the Attorney General at that time when you raised the issue?
Yes, there is. I was unaware of the statutory of 27-21-12.
Okay, so you didn't know about it. The city didn't know about it by their own admission. So for some reason, you found out about it and you immediately served the Attorney General, correct?
That's correct. When it came back from the Court of Appeals and another motion for summary judgment was filed by, we never got to the constitutional issue, by the way. All these other issues got in the way, but yes, when it came back from the court of reversed by the Court of Appeals, The city raised it for the first time in their motion for summary judgment. We saw that, looked the statute up, and responded, got in touch with the Attorney General's office, served them appropriately, 4.1, with a copy of the complaint. They wrote back and said they're not interested in participating. And
Counselor, what if they were interested in participating?
Well, if they were, then I think they would then file an appearance with the court or a motion with the court to participate.
Well, but could they have the arguments that the city submits now?
I'm sorry, what was that?
If the Attorney General's office wanted to participate and then got notice later on, as opposed to the inception of the case, and they complain that they were not served at the inception, what would happen to the case?
Well, I think that the trial court would has control over that situation. They could continue the hearings on the motion for summary judgment. They could allow the state, the Attorney General, to participate, to take discovery. They could do any number of things because they have the case.
But not dismiss the action, not dispose of the action.
I think if the Attorney General was heard and said that they wanted to participate or look into it, the trial court would grant them that opportunity. You know, as a practical matter, this was not a state statute that was at issue. It was a municipal ordinance. Mm-hmm. And I've looked at researched this a little bit, but the Attorney General rarely gets involved in these situations, and I suspect it's not all that interested in the constitutionality of a Cincinnati ordinance.
Doesn't this lead us back to Justice Donnelly's question about gamesmanship, where a person can wait to assert the constitutional claim and then serve the AG at a later point in time, and the AG is now under the gun? There's all these things that have happened, all these hearings that have taken place, all this discovery that's taken place. And now, well, you know what? At this late stage, we really just don't want to be involved. Doesn't that encourage gamesmanship?
I think the statute certainly allows the opportunity for gamesmanship. I'm not asserting here that the city has done that, but clearly the party could use that. And if they lose, then they could argue, well, there's no jurisdiction. I think the legislature should address this issue, and I think they should put in a definitive time limitation. They could say that the notice has to be served before a definitive motion is filed, or they could say that.
I thought you started off by saying the statute was unambiguous.
Yeah, I think it is unambiguous. I think what the court needs to be done is words need to be added, significant words, timing words. I don't think the lack of the timing makes it ambiguous. I think it just clearly says there is no time limitation, which I think is a problem, frankly.
If the service of process on the AG didn't occur at the first instance when it should have, would you then agree that there was a time period where the court did not have jurisdiction over this constitutional issue?
Well, if you read the statute, it makes this jurisdictional. I guess that would make the early rulings by the court, although they've been reversed, void maybe for not having jurisdiction.
Well, the reason I was asking you that is, it then seems if it's jurisdictional, and we somehow are able to skip past that jurisdiction not being raised when it should have been, and then we get into an analysis of prejudice, it seems like in every case we're going to go back retroactively and determine what was the level of prejudice as to whether or not the trial court did or didn't have jurisdiction. And in essence, doesn't that make the situation more messy than if we just follow the two Supreme Court cases that say it has to be when the constitutional issue is first raised? Isn't that our best precedent?
No, I don't believe so. I think that the legislature should speak to this issue. I don't think it's in the court's for the court to properly add a time limitation when the legislature clearly did not want to do so. It's a problem that they've created, and I think it's a problem that they should fix. I don't think it's up to this court to legislate and tell the legislature, you should have said that the service on the attorney general should be within 30 days of the service of the complaint, or when the definitive motion is filed, or when discovery, before discovery is commenced. I think you're changing the statute.
Well, I'm not trying to hijack your argument, but doesn't that take us back to Sitko and the previous Supreme Court case where the court said if the statute is ambiguous, we then try to look to what the intent of the legislature was, and the intent was at the commencement or when the issue was first raised?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I didn't.
No, that's fine. I think that's kind of what those cases suggest.
Yeah, but I'm not sure that we know what the intent of the legislature is here. I think the intent of the legislature may have been to leave this up to the attorney generals and let the attorney general decide whether they've been prejudiced by a late, arguably quote unquote late filing.
Does that mean the attorney general gets to determine when the court exercises subject matter jurisdiction?
I think it gives the attorney general the opportunity when they shall be heard. It gives them an opportunity when they are heard to do any number of things. They can elect like they did in this case and say, we're not interested. They could jump in with both feet and say, this is vitally important to us and we want to participate. I think that's what the intent of the legislature was, is to leave this up to the attorney general. Maybe that wasn't such a great idea. I don't know, and maybe we wouldn't have done it that way. I don't think I would have, but that's what they did. And my point is, we followed the statute as it was written, and I think, and no one has shown prejudice by the timing of this. And certainly the city who blames us for waiting 2.5 years, they also waited 2.5 years. They could have raised it on a 12B1 motion. And so I think the legislature should amend this statute and put in a definitive time limit so that you don't end up with a coming up here case by case basis trying to make sense out of the statute.
Well, it would not be necessary to do a case by case if we just say the statute, your case comports with Chico and it's at the inception, in other words, the beginning of the case.
Well, but I don't think that's the holding in Chico, Your Honor.
If we modify or clarify Chico and say this is what was intended and this is now crystal clear based on the Cincinnati versus Fourth National case, and then you become the touchstone for all cases going forward with this problem.
Well, I don't think inception of the case, I think you need to be more definitive than just inception. I'm not sure what the inception of the case really is.
We'd use more artful language than that, but that's the first thing that popped in my mind. Don't hold me to that.
Okay. I'm not holding you to anything, Your Honor. But my point is, as I raised earlier, is I think what this court should do is say that Forth has followed this statute, and it is within the holding of not the dicta maybe, but the holding of Chico, and it's up to the legislature to come forth, and if they want a specific time limitation, then they ought to insert it in the statute. And that way it's definitive and everybody knows when to do it.
Thank you, counsel.
I've used up my time. Thank you very much.
Yes, you have. Mr. Manning, used your time. You may take a minute.
I would just say, Your Honors, that we do know what the intent of the legislature is because this court said in Chico, both looking to the text and the purpose, what it is. And so I just ask this court to reaffirm what it says in Chico and reverse the First District Court of Appeals.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement and you'll be notified of our decision.